age is 38 years old. I am recording in Los Angeles, California. Today's date is June 10th, 2021. I will be speaking to Kay Keisel today, and our relationship is ex-colleague and very dear friend.
And my name is Kate Keisel. I'm 35 years old. I'm recording in New York. Today's date is June 10th, 2021, and I'll be speaking to Crystal, one of my dearest friends and one of my most respected colleagues in the field.
Kate, how are you doing, querida amiga?
I'm super bien. ¿Cómo estás tú, mi amor?
Te extraño.
Yo también.
So, you know, we've had a very, very close friendship. It's been, what, 12 years now?
Yeah.
And you were, I mean, we're good friends. We've worked together. And every time I feel like, and oh, you were in my wedding, right? Mm-hmm. A few years ago, I ended up being my informal wedding coordinator somehow last minute. But I feel like every time we do, because we worked before, I feel like as soon as we talk about work stuff, we get very serious and super formal. It's funny how we can kind of change the hat really quickly between the two. And so I'm really excited to do this today, because I get to ask you a few questions, and also because I really miss you. I feel like we don't get to talk as often as we would like to. You're busy, I'm busy, we have a lot going on. So anytime we have any kind of work-related project or something, you know, both professional or personal that we can do and we get to catch up, it's always so great, and I'm very excited to talk to you today.
Me too. And I'm super grateful that you're my talking partner. It's an honor to get to talk with you and to just memorialize the time that we've spent and grown in life together and look at all of those pieces. So I'm just really grateful for this opportunity to be here with you.
Yeah, likewise. Now, you know, it's been 12 years. Do you remember the first time we met? Do you remember?
Oh, yes. You sassy individual. I will never forget the first time we met. We were in Newark. Our former colleague, Chris, was driving the work car, and it was like freezing outside. And you got in the backseat of the car. We had never met before. I just started working at the office.
I think it was raining too.
It was like raining, and you had on like semi-platform shoes and were trying to change out of them and like sort of said hi to me. And I was like, oh my God, this girl's is not like me. And then from there, I was like, this Crystal is intense. And I was so intimidated. I was like, I just got to Newark. I've never been here. And I'm at this office and these are my new colleagues. And then from there, it turned into this beautiful relationship. But I can still see you like on the corner of Halsey in Newark, getting into the car being like, what's going on?
I know. I wasn't very friendly the first time we met. I don't know why. I think I was just like, who's this new girl here? Chick, I don't know her. Yeah, I remember that. I think it was just like crappy weather. And yeah, I wasn't very friendly because I think everything just happened so fast, right? There was like a new employee and it had been a long time, just Chris and I doing outreach, but it was great that you came on board because we needed our program to develop much more. And I mean, you were fabulous at the work itself. So, and then we became like BFFs shortly after that, I think almost immediately.
Yeah. I remember I literally had driven out from DC and was new to the area. And I think one of the like disservices to how we met was, you know, whenever there's like a new employee or a new staff in a team, like you and Chris didn't get to be a part of like deciding who came on. And that's hard, right? We want to be a part of that process. And I think that was something that we had to build in, which was like, all right, who are you? Mm-hmm. What are our stories? And then both being like, you know, neither of us are from New York or from the New Jersey area. What is it like here? And you were such a support then. And I just remember that switch happening so quickly.
Yeah, and there was no formal introduction or anything. It just kind of like happened, and we picked you up, and we were going to a meeting right shortly after that. It was just like, go, go, go. There was no transition. There was no like, hey, let's set up a meeting to introduce a new team member or anything. Well, we have a lot of interesting stories working in the rough streets, semi-rough streets of Newark, New Jersey, in the tri-state area, really, New York, New Jersey area. Now, going back a little bit, and I don't think I've ever asked you this in the 12 years I've known you, as a child, did you have any specific dreams about like what you were going to become or do when you grew up?
That's a really good question. I mean, as you know, I love animals, and I think I had always anticipated or thought or dreamed that I was going to do something like zoology or, you know, go into that path. And, you know, my own lived experiences and my own traumas of the past kind of changed that trajectory for me. And I always look back and think about, had I not gone through some of the things that I went through in my adolescence and in my early adulthood, that I probably wouldn't have been on this path. But I'm grateful for those experiences in the sense that they did shift. You know, I didn't go into zoology. I didn't get to do those things that I had initially thought would be my path, but I've been able to integrate that still into my work. So I do think a lot back to, you know, what led to this road and what could have been other pathways if life events had been different.
Right. Now, I know you mentioned that you were able to incorporate some of the initial passions you had as a child into your current work. Can you tell me a little bit about and what is it that you're doing to incorporate that still?
Yeah, I mean, I think, you know, when I was fortunate enough to co-found the Sanar Institute and an entity that was focused completely on healing trauma and trauma for individuals who've experienced human trafficking, but really any form of interpersonal violence, one of the things that was important to me was, one, looking at, you know, evidence-based modalities, but also looking at holistic healing. And I think one of the things that has been the most meaningful at Sanard, but even when you and I worked together, was integrating animal-assisted therapy. And I remember when you and I would have Rhea and Xochitl in the office and, you know, the individuals that would come in just had a whole different way of interacting and engaging when there were animals present in the office and feeling comfortable and feeling at home. And it wasn't a feeling of, you know, the typical idea of what it means to come into a service provider that's dry and scary and not person-centered, but it was more about, you know, let me sit with a Maltese or a Chiweenie while we are going through case management or really difficult times, talking about TNU visas and all of these really kind of try things that people have to face in the aftermath of trauma. And I think that's something that's stuck with me is the power of, you know, what animal assisted therapy or just having those living beings and creatures in areas and spaces where trauma is present, how much impact that can make. And I feel like that's just stayed with me and continues to stay with me now. I mean, I think about with where I'm living now, sort of going on this trajectory of having, you know, two new animal babies that are both in training for as therapy animals, that allows me to stay connected to that in a big way.
And what kind of animals are those?
So we have my newest addition is our baby Yasmin, who is a 12-week-old German Shepherd puppy who is going to be she has school tonight, so she'll be going to do search and rescue and also animal assisted therapy training. And she is a lot of energy, and I'm learning a lot about what it really looks like to raise a being with love, but also the training and consistency that takes. And she's also growing up with Rhea, who you know very, very well. Mm-hmm. As long as you've known me, you've known Rhea, who will be 14 this year, who is our Chiweenie, who I feel like has been to so many trainings and conferences and just different places. And then, of course, the fabulous Beyonce, our silky chicken, who is just affectionate and loving. And I'm seeing so much in her of how she is capable and has the, you know, the demeanor and the affect to really sit for long periods of time in a therapeutic way. So I'm really excited for when they will be ready to go into the office and become a part of the work also.
Yeah, I feel like our dogs have been advocates since we've been doing this work too, because you helped me get Sochi, my Maltese, who's now 10 years old or 9 years old, about to be 10 years old. And do you remember when we tried to sneak the dogs into the hotel in Washington, D.C.? And I am someone that's kind of by the books. I get scared to break the law in any way or policy. And you're like, just put her in your bag. You know, I had a big bag, tote bag. And I tried to sneak her in there. And then her little tail was sticking out. And the guy from the hotel saw it. And I was like, oh my God. And you're like, it's fine. You always like push me to do things that I was like, just not comfortable, like, especially with the dog, like, you know, in the airport or anything. I was new to dogs back then. And I was like, no, it says no dogs allowed. And you were like, just put her in the bag.
I remember when he asked you, is that a dog? And you were like, no.
And then her tail, her big white fluffy toe was swinging left to right. I looked down. I was like, oops. Okay, I'm just going to walk out now.
And we had to be at like the 10-year anniversary gala event in like an hour. I remember him being like, we have to find alternative childcare in the next like 30 minutes to make it to the gala. And like, we had someone with us who was speaking at it. And
it was like a colleague's boyfriend who was able to take her in for the next few hours, right?
Just last minute. Yeah, we were like, we have an emergency.
We have a lot of really funny stories, I feel like, just adventures from when we used to work together.
Yes.
We can do a whole podcast on that in itself. And now, I know you mentioned earlier, I think it was one of the questions I asked you about your dreams and what you wanted to become. And you said there were some personal experiences that you went through that changed that trajectory. And if you feel comfortable sharing a little bit about those personal experiences that change, because I feel like that happens to a lot of people. You know, one thing leads to another that leads to another, and then you find yourself in this new pathway. I remember for me, I took a criminology course. I wanted to be a police officer, and then I took a couple of victim services classes, and immediately I was like, oh, I need to, you know, I still work within the criminal justice field, but more leaning towards victim services because of those courses I took and because of a lot of things that I've experienced, my mom experienced, that I saw in my community. What were some of those personal experiences that you kind of hinted at earlier that influenced the work that you do now?
Yeah, I mean, you know, there's the obvious pieces, I think, that we talk a lot about and sensationalize, right? So experiences of sexual violence and intimate partner violence and those different aspects that were all a part of my history. And those definitely shaped those. And I think also growing up with individuals who were my closest friends that also had those same experiences of ongoing sexual violence and ongoing intimate partner violence, I think the realization in the long term was, you know, this is not something that's isolated. This is something that is prevalent and everywhere and happening to everyone that I love and care about. And I think, you know, when I went through different experiences of traumatic events really, you know, throughout adolescence and then early adulthood. And one of the major traumas that I went through, you know, in the aftermath of that, I was a different person. It changed something fundamentally in me and how I saw the world and how I was able to relate to other people. And I think that changed my pathway completely. I mean, you know, I think about when I was an undergrad and what I thought things were going to look like. And I did, you know, as you know, much of my undergraduate degree in Latin America, both in Mexico and in Peru. And I think I had such a fundamental processing time of trying to work through that trauma while also going through and trying to finish education and, you know, then processing earlier traumas. And then you start to realize they're all connected. And I think it took me a really long time to place and understand how my lived experience was going to have meaning that was more than just pain or more than just disconnection. And I think, you know, kind of tying that to the present, one of the things that I was really fortunate was to have access to really, really good and supportive care at a certain point in time. And I remember my life before I was able to access things like eye movement desensitization and reprocessing, EMDR therapy, and some of these other things that now I'm able to offer as a practitioner and as a trauma therapist, but I had to do my own work first. And that work is long-term. It's never really over. But I am so focused now at this point in my life and this trajectory in what post-traumatic growth looks like and what resiliency looks like. And I'm such a firm believer that, you know, really what we think about in post-traumatic growth is we become wholer people, more empathic people, more self-aware when we're able to do that work and heal from that trauma, so that trauma actually becomes a guidepost that allows us to be more human. And that doesn't mean that we wish for traumatic events, or that doesn't mean that we excuse them, but that we also can take our own personal accountability and say, no one is going to heal me but myself in this process. And I think that's something for me when I look at all of the different things that I went through and I experienced, it informs things today even, right? Not in the sense of I try to really be objective about my own experiences versus, you know, when I work with individuals and on their healing journey, but the idea that, you know, healing from trauma is not, it's not a mystery. It's not something that we don't know as a field how to get to, but that it has everything to do with who has access, resources, and power. And that's unacceptable. So I think for me, that's that those experiences have led my passion to what it means to have access to quality, appropriate healing services that don't pathologize trauma, right? It's not something that's wrong with us. Right. It's an experience that we have that we overcome. So I feel like that was a really long-winded answer to kind of like tie all of those together to who I am today, which is, you know, it's informed by all of those experiences. They're a part of me. I don't disown them. I give them place and space, but they also are just one tiny piece of the pie. I feel like there's so many different parts of me that I've been fortunate to develop that were only possible in that healing process. And I think that that should be a human right for every single person who experiences trauma, which is just one of the most prevalent things that we will experience as humans.
Absolutely. Yeah. And I love that you did a lot of work internationally too, in Peru and Mexico, which is, I'm assuming, how you learned to speak Spanish fluently.
Yeah. Yeah. When I first moved to Cusco, I didn't speak Spanish at all. I think I had taken like a Spanish like 101 course at one point. But you don't have any other choice, right? When you're living in, at the time I was living with a host family there for that year. And then by the time I moved to Mexico, my Spanish was better. And then I started to really understand like differences in even just vocabulary and some of the nuances. And then it just became a part of sort of, you know, having sort of a place in my brain where I switched over it from English to Spanish pretty fluidly over time.
Yeah, I love that. I really do. I think that's one of the ways that we connected. I was like, okay, she speaks Spanish. I like you. I'm just kidding. And now I know you talked a lot about your trauma and your personal experiences and the reason why you're so passionate about ensuring that everyone has access to the correct and appropriate trauma-centered therapy, counseling, and all this services for gender-based violence victims. And one of the words that always gets thrown out there in the field, in the work that we do, is resilience. How would you define resilience?
It's so funny. I'm working on this curriculum right now on trauma specifically relating to human trafficking. And one of the parts of it is defining definitions of the course. And, you know, there's like the textbook definition, which is the ability to bounce back after adversity. But to me, I feel like there are so many other elements to that. And I've seen resilience every single day that I get to come to work. And the way that I see it is the ability to sit with the pain and still move forward. So it's a learning and self-awareness aspect in addition to a growth aspect. And I think resilience to me means, it means that fluidity of moving forward, of not getting stuck, because I think it's so easy for us to get stuck in the hurt parts, in the hard parts, and justifiably so. But I think resilience holds us accountable to actively participate in our healing. And when we see that, when we have that light bulb moment, I feel like that's when the resilience in individuals comes out, is this strength that is deeply rooted in the authentic self. I feel one of the things that I am most honored and grateful is to witness resilience every single day. I think people talk about, you know, you work with trauma, and at the end of the day, I work with resilience. I work with individuals who are able to get up, overcome, and continue working on 1,000 things in life that are outstanding. And those traumas are so diverse, but that ability to come back to the table, to be brave again, to be courageous again, to try to be in a relationship again, trust again, all of those things, I think, are such a key part of what resilience looks like. And I also truly, truly believe that resilience is compassion, not just compassion for ourselves, but for others. Because I one of the things that I see and that saddens me in the field is a lack of compassion and person-centeredness. And I think that's a part of resilience that we all can tap into a little bit more, which is even when we think about working with colleagues or other professionals, sometimes we don't give the same respect that we would give to someone who's perceived to be a client. And yet when we think about that, we don't know people's stories. We're never going to know people's stories, and we should never be required to self-disclose our personal experiences. And we ultimately have to come with that resilience, which is being able to show up with compassion. I think when we don't have that, we're missing a little piece of it. And that usually is because we have a part of us or a piece of us that's still hurt.
Yeah. Or burnt out, or other things that I think is also important to address in the work that we do. But going back to, as you were going through the different definitions of resiliency, what are your sources of resilience? I know you mentioned being able to see it on a day-to-day basis with the clients that you work.
So that's such a good question, Crystal. And I feel like I don't want to be like cliche, and I want to be really honest. I feel like time with my partner, who is the absolute love of my life, who has shown me a different way of living and shifted my perception of what it means to not just be all in with work, where I am still there and very present. And I think I do better work now that I don't work inappropriately hard, right? Where I'm not overworking and using that as a form of not being present in my life. I think that's a huge form of and source of what grounds me. I think time in nature, and now living in a place where I get to see animals and life and people who are living in different ways. I think travel has been a huge part of that as well, of seeing lots of different communities and what healing looks like and what resiliency looks like there. I've been so honored with the work that we do in Southern India and working with communities there and seeing what resilience means to them. So I feel like all of those are sources, but at the end of the day, I think it's also making sure that I feel like I'm being true to my values and myself. And when those are aligned, I feel my most resilient. I feel my most true. I feel my most true version of myself. And I think that's the essence that I see also in the people that I work with, as building that authenticity and that comfort of setting boundaries, of saying, you know, this doesn't feel okay to me, or this is something that made me uncomfortable, or, you know, having that voice, having that choice in all things in life, I think for me is a source of resiliency. And I learn from the people around me. I mean, I learn from you all the time too, where I'll be like, Crystal, how do you do this? Like, how are you able to process this? Or how are you able to not let this get to you or let this go? And so I think that's another huge piece are my friendships. I'm so lucky to have a tribe of women that are my rocks, and I couldn't do life without you and the women in my life.
Oh, I feel the same way. I really do. Whenever I have an issue, I'm like, Kate, please be my informal therapist as well as my informal wedding coordinator. You do it all.
I remember when your DJ thought I was a hired wedding coordinator and was like getting frustrated with me. And I was like, I'm not a part of this like formal anything.
I didn't have a wedding coordinator, so I just made you one the day of the wedding or the day before the wedding, right?
I think you said something like, isn't that your job? And I was like, I don't have a job. I'm a guest.
I know. It was so funny. He gave you attitude, but then he like realized like, okay, she was just helping out.
She's like, where is the song list? I'm like, I don't know where the song list is. I'll go ask Crystal.
Poor Kate, that was so funny. Trying to like pay the florist. This is all in Mexico, thank God, you know, because you spoke Spanish. So I was like, okay, you're going to pay the mariachi band and you're going to play the florist. Here's the money.
Oh my gosh, I forgot your mariachi band too, that was like late and I kept calling them and I'm like, how many minutes out are you really? Like, be straight with me, because you've said 15 minutes for like an hour now and my girl is about to arrive, and I know if you're not here, that's not going to work.
Oh, that was hilarious. There's so much that happened that day. Now, I know we talked a little bit about what you dreamed of becoming, your personal experiences and resilience leading up to currently, you know, the kind of work that you do, resiliency of the victims you work with, the survivors you work with, but also your own personal resilience and how, what those sources are like for you. Has anyone in your life been kind of the mentor or someone like a role model that you looked up to that helped you get to where you are now?
I feel like my grandmother, who passed away a few years ago, was one of those people that I look to even now. And I think like, what would Betty do? She was an artist and completely unapologetically herself all the time, and adored me no matter what I did, no matter what I went through, no matter the challenges. She was just that person who thought I was just amazing, right? It was like, if I took a picture, she would be like, you are a photographer. And I mean, you know, regardless if there was any merit to what or truth to it, she believed it. And I think to have someone that sees you that way and loves you that way is just an ultimate gift. But also to see how she navigated her life all the way to the very end when she passed away, and the humor that she brought, the confidence that she brought. And she always believed that no matter what, I could accomplish anything that I wanted to, no matter what had happened, no matter, you know, what challenges were there. And to have that unconditional love and to have that fighter spirit that she had. I mean, she was someone, you know, who was a trailblazer. You know, she got a divorce in a time when you don't get divorced, right? When she was very young in her early 20s, after being married for, I think, 6 months, and then went on to meet my grandfather and had a whole other life. She was born in Chicago and had a job offer in Los Angeles, and her boss asked her to drive this convertible for his wife and was like, do you want to do it? And she said, yes. And, you know, her coworker was like, Betty, you don't know how to drive. She was like, I'll learn, you know? And so I think that spirit of just like, nothing is going to stop me from doing these things. And she traveled alone in a time when that wasn't something that was easy or accessible. So she's someone I frequently look at in terms of living a full life and what does it mean to be a person who is loving and yet also boundaried and strong for yourself.
Yeah, I like that. The combination, the balance of both. Now, is there anybody else that maybe helped you? Because you've done a lot. Since I've known you, you've grown so much professionally, personally. But was there anybody else in your life that helped you emotionally or maybe financially or academically to in any sense of the word, to achieve your dreams?
I think my mom has been always there. She's a phenomenal woman and has been one of those people as well. I know no matter what, she will be there for me. I think that's a huge gift. And I realize more and more it's a gift that not everyone has. And I cherish that and I cherish her. And I also really believe that, you know, my core friendships have been that as well. You have been that. You have been like a phenomenal support to me in so many different, really difficult moments in the last 12 years. That I don't know how I would have made it through without your support, without your guidance, without your love towards me, even in moments when I was imperfect, even in moments when I would have liked to have been a different version of myself, even when I didn't know what life was going to bring. You were that person. Who I consider my sister, who I am the godmother of her two sons, has been in my life since we were children. And we voice text or communicate every day. And that, you know, these people that you know will be there in your life until the end. So I think those are huge pieces of that. I also think that I've had really good fortune of having individuals professionally that have been there to give me guidance and support and mentorship that I am so grateful for. Clinical supervisors who really helped me to become the therapist that I am today, who I am so grateful for and have that relationship with. And I'm like, I don't want to mention people's names because I'm not sure if they want their names mentioned, but I know who you are and you know who you are. And I think those are all pieces of people who believed in me along the way and who showed me that I could accomplish things that didn't necessarily look like what it does in every package. It, you know, I don't come from having an Ivy League education, but I do have and have pursued my, you know, academic goals and was able to go to grad school and do these different things. And people telling me that I had skills and tools and abilities to show up and fostered and nurtured those. So I do think, you know, we become the people we are by the people we're surrounded with as well and who and what they show us. I also think it can't go without saying the people that I have walked side by side on their journey of healing have been my biggest source of learning also. I am humbled and honored by the stories that I have bared witness to over many, many, many years and every single day. And every time that I do a session or that I am engaging with someone, I'm very conscious that it is an honor to have someone trust and share their story with you. And I take that with the utmost ethical guidance and also just humanity and heart. It's something I'm uncompromising with, is the people that I work with who trust me, who trust the organization that they're coming to. And I think those are the people that I also learn from and seeing, my gosh, like the extent to which people are able to not just overcome, but are such amazing humans is so inspiring and also it makes me grow as a person, right? It challenges me to say, reflect in on yourself, and are you doing these same things?
Yeah, absolutely. I think you get so much from the people that you work with and survivors. And I'm just like, how did you go through all of that? And yet you smile and you're so happy, and you know, you would never know that these people have suffered so much or have gone through so much in life. And so I completely understand that. Now, kind of going a little bit, moving a little bit forward on the same topic, along the same topic, what would you say is, what lasting change would you say you have made in your community that you are the most proud of, or in the anti-trafficking field that you are the most proud of?
I think it's a complicated piece for me. I think what I'm most proud of in the work that I'm doing today and that I've been able to do with Senar is not compromising on what it means to change the dialogue around trauma and to take away the sensationalized storytelling, an exploitation of traumatic events that individuals move through, and to change that to a narrative around resilience and growth, to recenter the conversation around being human and to look at trauma from a lens of something that's universal, right? The non-othering of individuals who've experienced trafficking, and seeing it as something to observe and think of as other people, but instead looking at this is a trauma and a traumatic event that an individual has gone through, and this does not mean that is their full self. And we can all use our own lived experiences and say, are our traumatic experiences our full self? And I think that's the piece in the field that I hope to always accomplish, is giving tools and skills to move the conversation beyond the quote unquote trauma-informed work and really say, like, do we understand trauma? And do we understand how we can, oftentimes with good intentions, disempower the very individuals that we're trying to work with and continue to have the same solutions over and over again that are put out there, whether that's through funding sources or through the types of programs that are continuing to thrive that are not actually making impact. So I think for me, going to an impact focused area where we measure trauma, we know what kind of modalities we're using, we create a holistic person-centered environment, we do not exploit stories, we do not ask people to tell stories, we are respectful of power dynamics. I'm proud of that work. I'm proud of the team that does that work every single day at Senar. I feel proud when they are represented in the community, and I really am inspired by that continuing to grow and to shifting the narrative away from so many misconceptions that there are with trafficking and the imbalance and lack of focus on the impact of labor trafficking and things of that nature. I think those are some of the pieces that I really feel passionate about continuing, and also feel like there has been some movement, but there's a lot of work to still do to get to that place.
What kind of message would you give a younger version of Kate or a younger version of Crystal, you know, future advocates that want to join in the movement? Maybe they're 19, 20 years old and they're starting to get interested in it. What would you tell them about this work?
Oh, sorry. I was like, are you done? What message would I give? That human trafficking and working with individuals and communities that have been impacted by human trafficking is working with people. And you need to be passionate about working with people, all kinds of people, and people that are just humans like ourselves. So if you're coming to this work because it's having a lot of exposure, or it seems so horrific that you have to do something about it, move away from that sensationalized conversation, right? Move away from that idea that this is othering or that it looks a certain way. Educate yourself about what trafficking looks like and those missing parts of the story. Right? We are just starting to talk about the impact in Indian country with immigrant communities, all of these different pieces. And we need to have full narratives. We have to stop having an academic monopolized narrative of this work and have a lived experience and expertise narrative that is changing and guiding that story and make sure that we come into this work for the right reasons. I think that's the piece of, it's not about us. It's not about our ego. It's not about thank you for your service. It's you're doing such great work because you work in the anti-trafficking field. We should be here because we care about people and we care about ourselves and we see that reflection of ourselves in this work. And that's my opinion. That doesn't have to be the only one.
Absolutely. Yeah, I think you made it very clear that sometimes, and we've seen this in the work that we've done before, they would always ask us, bring a survivor to come and speak at this conference. We want to see a survivor come and speak. But you can see their intention wasn't truly to make a difference and understand the topic. It was like, I want to see a trafficking survivor. What do they look like? And I want to hear their story. And, you know, was it sex? Okay, yeah, we want a sex trafficking survivor. We don't care too much about labor trafficking stories and then finding solutions to ensure that these victims are getting the right services. So I completely understand. And it was very frustrating, right? And us as advocates trying to protect survivors, yet also educate the community on the topic. So I do agree with you that sometimes that gets lost in the work for some folks, not all. So I appreciate that you're speaking about that. And I hope that we have a lot more advocates that feel the same way and are fully aware of that. And if not, I'm sure we'll let them know. we'll let them know.
I think that would be my biggest hope for the field is that we change that narrative, right? We change that narrative away from why are we asking certain questions? Why are we focusing on certain details? Why are we looking at individuals who've had this lived experience and only asking about this one lived experience? When we ask someone to come speak and talk about their lives, we don't want them in those things to talk about their lives. They're being requested to talk about a very certain part of their lives. And as someone with my own lived experience, I can think of nothing more offensive than being reduced down to a traumatic event, right? And not being seen as anything but that. Mm-hmm. So I think that there is a huge importance of lived experience guidance, but there's also a balance in that, that we as society have to ask ourselves tough questions about what is the purpose and why are we asking these questions and what's missing from the story, what's missing from the narrative, and what are harmful misconceptions that just continue to do harm for individuals, especially in the future, right? When you've been told and only asked about one part of you, how do you develop other parts of yourself that feel as important when people are not asking about them or interested in them? So I think we have an opportunity to view people as full people.
Absolutely. Now, just to kind of end things on a less serious note, because you know me, I think for me, my source of resilience comes back to sense of humor and laughing because I have to. That's the way I keep myself sane. Can you remember, I don't know if you have a specific funny moment or story that you can remember about the work that you do, either us working together or just, I know we shared a couple of funny moments at the beginning, but do you have a particular one that stands out that was maybe the funniest moment you've experienced while maybe working?
I feel like you and I have so many funny stories. I'm like cycling through funny stories, but I think one that just shows like what life looks like is, I feel like it's always like winter in Newark when I think of funny stories with you and I, but I remember us leaving the office after a super long day. And I think we had a couple of crisis responses and you had Xochitl on a leash and she started running towards Halsey Street where there were all these cars and you're running after her and then you slip on the ice and I'm running after her and we're like this chaos on the street of Newark and like everything we had done in terms of our work day was just like impaled in comparison to this moment. At the end of it, I just remember us like freezing on the ice laughing, and I think that's the part of it at the end is I think of so much humor and laughing and also being like Xochitl almost died, okay, we're fine.
Oh my god, I had to jump on her because she was about to go onto the main. It was after hours, like everybody was driving pickup traffic. Oh my God. And like,
girl, you like lost yourself on her. I was like, you are Mama Bear. Like, you are not crossing that street. I was like, that was admirable. You held that down fast and shut it down.
Oh, I dropped my lunch bag. I mean, I feel like we always used to fall in the ice in Newark, right? Like, I felt like we were just cold and uncomfortable. A lot of accidents, a lot of changing tires on our work car. You know, I didn't even know how to change a tire. Somehow we learned on the job.
Yes, many times. So that would be another one, is I think you and I in the snow in Brooklyn,
yeah,
leaving a crisis response, and like both of us trying to step on the piece to take the, I'm like, I don't even know the parts of the tire. The tool. I'm like, the tool. And we were both like trying to use our body weight to move it, to get it to like go around. And finally someone came over and was like, do you like a hand with that? And we were like, you know what? I think we're going to say yes to that.
Oh Lord. Yes, absolutely. We had a lot of funny moments. Now, I think we're running out of time. If we still have time, I would like to just ask you if there's anything, any message that you want to tell the anti-trafficking field or any other advocate. I know you shared a lot of sort of the sensationalizing trafficking, the stories and things like that. But is there anything else, any other message that you want to share with the anti-trafficking field?
Be kind. Be kind to everyone that you work with, everyone that you interact with. Be compassionate. Strive to be the best versions of ourselves. Even when we may not agree on issues, at the end of the day, we can all be kind. And I think that would be the biggest message that I have every day, is just let's all be kind, compassionate, and gentle to one another, no matter what kind of work we do, what histories might be there, what goals may align or may not align. We can all disagree, have different opinions, and do so with kindness and treat one another with human dignity, care, and compassion.
Amen. Well, thank you, Kate. This has been lovely. It's so fun to talk to you all the time. We always laugh and at the same time talk about really serious things. I love that balance.
Thank you, Crystal. I love you dearly, and I'm just so grateful that you're in my life, and thank you for spending your morning with me. I'm so grateful for you.
Thank you. Likewise.